Today, we're in Iowa, where Democrat candidates are fighting to win the first key battle in the race to take on Donald Trump. And how much do you really know about male circumcision? Chris, you've been spending quite a lot of time in Iowa in recent months. Tell me about what it's like as a place.
Well, by British standards, it's very big. You can drive for miles and not see very many people. See a lot of grain barns, huge fields of corn and of soybeans. You get sprawling farms interspersed with some fairly big cities. Because it's a sprawling agricultural state, it's generally a pretty quiet place. But once every 4 years, it goes slightly mad as the presidential bandwagon rolls into town.
Iowa is about to dazzle the country with a raucous caucus next Monday night. And it's really round two of the Civil War Democrats started 4 years ago.
Democrats are crisscrossing that state, trying to connect with voters and taking new aim at their opponents.
Literally, a presidential candidate could knock on your door at any point, right?
And in fact, it happens often. How you
doing? And this is still anyone's race. The latest polling showing people here in Iowa have not made up their minds.
For the 12 Democrats still in the race to become their party's nominee for president, the past few months of campaigning, handshaking and burger flipping have led up to tonight, the Iowa caucuses. In this swing state, which has voted for both Barack Obama and Donald Trump, Democrats will, for the first time, get to have a say on who will be their chosen candidate in 2020. This is a crucial test. In recent years, every winner in Iowa has gone on to secure the Democratic nomination. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the Iowa caucuses and the race for the White House. Chris McGreal, you're covering the US election in the Midwest, and right now you're in Iowa because tonight, this is where we'll begin to get an idea of who will be challenging Donald Trump in November's election. How does the process work?
Both major parties do the same thing, which is that when they're choosing a candidate, it moves from state to state, each candidate competing with the other to win the most votes in that state and get delegates to the party's convention later in the year. The candidate with the most delegates ends up as the nominee, as the presidential candidate for that particular party. Trump's an incumbent, so he's really not having to compete against anybody, but it's a wide-open Democratic race at the moment. So Iowa's slightly unusual. It and a handful of other states have something called caucuses. Now, most states, they just do a straightforward ballot. You go in, it's like a general election. You mark your candidate on the ballot and you drop it in the box. Caucuses are slightly different in that you go to a meeting. They're all held at the same time, 7 o'clock this evening. They're held in town halls, in churches, in schools. And you go along, and surrogates, effectively, people who support a particular candidate, put their case.
So this is about as close to real as it gets. We're at Drake University, where they're holding a mock caucus, basically a dress rehearsal for what they're doing next Monday night. Students who've been organizing on campus for the past year, doing what they will actually do in gymnasiums and libraries and church basements across the state next week, gathering people into corners and trying to convince any undecided voters what to do. Not surprisingly, given their youth, the Sanders corner, quite active. Notably, take a look at this, the Biden corner, not so much.
Everybody talks, questions are asked, and then people divide up and they go to different corners of the room according to who they support, and then they're just counted. There's nothing secret about it. It's quite open. You effectively declare publicly who you are supporting.
For those who are still in the running for the Democrats, you know, how much groundwork do they have to put in Iowa?
They pile into the state.
Presidential hopefuls descended on Iowa again Saturday for the annual Democratic steak fry. More than 11,000 people showed up at the Polk County event.
Former Vice President Joe Biden, it's not his first time here at the fair, in fact.
And Mayor Pete Buttigieg speaking at several different town halls on Wednesday. And plot twist, a cat crashed the stage at one of his events.
You've seen the candidates crisscrossing, sometimes holding a dozen meetings a day. They might be somebody's front room, some of them, or local diners. Some of them are in big university halls. But the whole idea is to get out there, meet the public face to face, meet the voters face to face.
A candidate really needs to come to my home, right? Like, they need to come to my school, they need to come to my church. And so we expect to meet presidential candidates, we expect to shake their hands, we expect to look them in the eye, we expect to be able to ask them the questions.
Many people in Iowa go and see the candidates, and they consider a responsibility to the nation. I mean, one of the things about Midwesterners is, you know, they're incredibly courteous, but they will call you out.
For the past few months, you've gone back and forward to Iowa, and you've also visited other key swing states. From your conversations with people that you've met along the way, what do you think is on the minds of Democrat voters?
In a sense, the vote is coming down into two kinds of categories. There are those who are looking for the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. And in that sense, they want their candidate to be the least vulnerable person and the most capable person in terms of running an election, electability. And then you've got the more ideological who are looking at the candidates with the best policies, the issues that they align with, and particularly those people who feel that for much too long, the Democrats have really just been Republicans light, and they're going for policy considerations, for ideological considerations. And really, increasingly, that's what the decision-making is coming down to.
So another way of putting it is that people are deciding whether to back who they personally want to be president versus who they think can be president based on who they think everybody else in the country will vote for in November. And right now there are 12 Democrat candidates, but most people think there are only four with a chance of winning: Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Joe Biden. He's the first candidate that comes to mind when you talk about electability. He's considered the safest pair of hands. But what are his policies?
Well, his policies, in a way, are less important than that safest pair of hands. I think that's his principal policy, actually. That's his selling point. Now, he does have policies. He has policies to raise the minimum wage for workers, a plan to introduce a public health insurance option.
My plan calls for taking Obamacare and building on Obamacare, restoring all the cuts that the president made, making sure that the 160 million people like that young lady who asked the question, if they like their private plan, they can keep it.
His view is essentially that the ship of state has got a few problems. It's a bit off course. Maybe it's listing a bit. It just needs righting and putting back on course. Whereas Sanders, his view would be that the ship of state has been boarded by pirates and is sinking.
And how does he sell himself to voters?
He sells himself as the stable leader, the one with the authority. And how does that go down? It depends on which side of that divide we were talking about. If you are a voter who just wants to get Trump out the White House, you look at Biden and think, that may be my best bet. What's your name?
My name is Shirley Crippen.
And I heard that encapsulated in the view of Shirley Crippen at one of the Democrat rallies.
I'm a 100% supporter of Joe Biden. First of all, because of his experience. That's my primary commitment to him. The win is totally dependent upon the people that are independents, maybe Republicans that lean a little left. It's the people that are undecided. Maybe some of the people that voted for Donald Trump last time only because they thought he would be different. And now they know that he is definitely different, but in a terrible way. We need to get them out to vote. And again, I think Joe's the one to do that.
How has Biden's campaign been going so far in Iowa? He's clashed with voters a couple of times, hasn't he?
Yes, generally they're very calm. In fact, they're far more staid than many of the other candidates' rallies. You go to a Biden rally and sometimes it feels a bit like an old people's home. Everybody's sitting in chairs, middle-aged, maybe a bit older, and politely clapping. There's not a lot of the energy that you get at a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren rally. But every now and again, Biden, you know, cracks, so to speak, and he has lashed out at voters. He's got into disputes with voters.
You're selling access to the president just like he does. So you're
a damn liar, man. That's not true. And no one has ever said that. No one has heard that.
I see it on the TV.
You see it on the TV. No, I know you do. And by the way, that's why I'm not sedentary. I don't like it up and no, let him go. Let him go. Look, the reason I'm running is because I've been around a long time and I know more than most people now. And I can get things done. That's why I'm running. And you want to check my shape on, let's do push-ups together, man. Let's run. Let's do whatever you want to do. Let's take my
So you can see under the surface that there's a bit of a temper there, really. Some of the voters, at least, are looking for somebody who's going to stand up to Donald Trump. But obviously, without descending into his methodology, Biden's always looked like that man. But it might seem that if Trump provokes him in the right way, we'll see Biden lash out, and that may not be good for him.
Yeah, push back and not challenging him to push-ups. The other moderate in this race is Pete Buttigieg. He's much less well-known than Joe Biden is. How much time has he spent in Iowa?
He spent a lot of time. And the fact that we're talking about him at all is down to that groundwork, that leg game in Iowa. He's completely put himself on the map. He's knocked on a lot of doors. He's had a lot of meetings. He's very personable. You can see him in operation. People like him. He was in the military, and that makes a big difference, particularly to people in the Midwest. A lot of people out here have that history. They've served.
This morning, navigating the White Rose of the Veterans Cemetery that we were able to visit today for a very moving ceremony, I found myself again reflecting on a kind of dictatorship of chance that leaves some of us walking on top of the grass while others are beneath it.
That matters to people. It's also seen as a sign of not only commitment to the country, but stability, actually.
And in terms of this question of electability, his argument is very similar to Biden's. He says that he can unite both sides and close this middle ground by offering something a little more moderate than some of the other candidates. Do you think he can do that?
Up to a point. He is a unifying figure for a lot of voters who see him as encapsulating a lot of what they like and what they're looking for in a candidate. And one of those is Laura Hubke, the chair of the Democratic Party in northeastern Iowa, Howard County.
In 2016, you were a Sanders supporter.
Yeah.
So tell me why you've ended up here.
Because I am just a very utopian, I'm a hippie. And I think that's why I liked Bernie last time, because I was like, yes, the kids like him. He's talking about healthcare. And he's been, you know, I never really knew about him. And looking back 40 years ago, he was marching, he was fighting, he was talking about all this income inequality for 40, 50 years. I'm like, oh, where's this guy been? That's what we need, a champion. And then when we butted up against reality, I could see where America was. I'm like, okay, we're not there yet. I think why I like Pete, because I think he's in the middle of everybody. And I feel like that's why he's gained traction here.
But when you look at Buttigieg, he represents one of the more complicated aspects of this whole thing, because it's not just about your politics, but also about your identity. He's gay, and depressingly, this is coming into conversation a lot when people talk about him, isn't it?
Yes, it is. One of those people who has no issue at all with it is Laura Hubke.
Like, is that going to be a problem? The older voters that came in here, I thought for sure a couple of people, that Linda and Dick, you know, I thought they would be one of those people I could sound it off. And he goes, I don't care. I thought, because they're more middle of the road voter. I thought for sure he'd be like, oh, that might be a problem. He's like, nobody gives a shit.
But while Laura Hubke doesn't have an issue, there are people that do. And they fall into two categories, really. The first category are those people that will not vote for a gay president. That might be for religious reasons. They are almost certainly a minority, but they're there. But they have an impact on another group of voters, who are the people that fear. They have no problem with a gay president, but what they do have a fear of is that he will cause some people to hesitate. And so it causes them to hesitate if they're looking for the best person to beat Trump. They think it will be used against him. And one of those is Ashley Moore, who was at a Sanders vote.
I feel like within the last 3 years since Trump has been in office, he has really fueled a lot of hatred. I mean, just listen to him on TV. Listen to what he says. Usually it's not something positive, unfortunately. So I'm really concerned about all of those issues. I like Pete, but I do have concerns that he would not be as electable because of who he loves and his husband, because of some people's views.
What is Buttigieg's answer to that?
He says, get to know me. And to some degree, he's right. I mean, there's no doubt that in Iowa, as people have got to know him, they've overlooked it. I've actually spoken to other voters, one voter in particular, who told me outright he's a homophobe. But he realized that was his problem and he had to get past it, and he liked everything else about the guy, so he was going to vote for him. That is Buttigieg's line, is ask yourself whether this really matters in the grand scheme of things when there are so much more that we should be considering.
Okay, so let's take a turn to the other front runners in this race, the more left-wing candidates, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. How do their policies differ from those of Biden and Buttigieg?
Both are candidates about radical change. That's really it. And one of the things that's really noticeable about this election in 2020 is the agenda has been set by Sanders' campaign in 2016. If you look back to what he was talking about then, it is at the heart of the policies that even Joe Biden is talking about in 2020. So Sanders is the man who really decided the trajectory of this election in policy terms. The principal thing he's put on the agenda is healthcare reform. Now, that's a huge issue for a lot of American voters, whatever their political persuasion.
The American people want a healthcare system that works for them, not for huge profits for the drug companies who are ripping us off every day and the insurance companies. At the end of the day, we will create more jobs. Will there be some job loss? Yes, there will.
Something that young people very much relate to is the huge increase in the cost of going to university, the cost of college tuition. And that's something that Sanders talks about just wiping out. No, we're going to get rid of that. So Ashley Moore had gone to the Sanders rally with an open mind, but she'd listened to him talk. I spoke to her afterwards. And one of the things that really leapt out to her is what he had to say about erasing college debt.
He fights for what is the most important thing to me, which is education. I have terrible student loans, and it's hard to really plan for the future and live the life that I'd love to live. Not something extravagant, but when you have student loan payments that are a lot. Let's just say they're a lot each month.
Do you mind my asking how much debt you have?
It's well into the six figures, let's say that.
Okay.
Underpinning that is the whole question of the way that corporate capitalism works in America and its influence on politics, its corrupting influence on politics. And that's very much an issue that Elizabeth Warren takes on as well.
I got a plan. Part one, attack corruption head on.
As a senator, she was instrumental in passing legislation to essentially rein in the banks and their influence on politics, but also to hold them to account to the consumers. So that kind of idea that there's something very structurally wrong with the way American capitalism works and that it's no longer delivering for the average American worker.
Certainly there are a lot of Democrats that really like the ideology behind what Sanders and Warren have to say. But some do think that these ideas are just a bit too radical to win in America. In other words, Sanders and Warren have a bit of a problem when it comes to electability. Is that what you heard from people in Iowa?
Yes, and I think that it's a twofold thing. One is, are these policies too radical? And they certainly are for some people. Healthcare insurance is a good example. So Sanders would like to see essentially the government take over all healthcare insurance so that you pay through your taxes. Now, there are plenty of people in this country who are deeply unhappy with their health insurance, but there's also quite a lot of people who get fairly good, cheap insurance through their employer, and they don't want to lose it. And I think that touches on a second element of the concern about Sanders and Warren, is how much people trust the government to implement this. It's not just that the policies are very radical, but even if they like the policies, do they really trust the government to do it?
Biden and Buttigieg are focusing on winning back the voters lost to Trump. Are Warren and Sanders taking the same approach?
Sanders and Warren are both aware of this electability question. And Sanders says up front, early on now in his rallies, he's been saying,
this campaign, both the primary and the general election, will be dependent upon one thing, and that is voter turnout.
Look, we're not winning back those voters who went from Obama to Trump. They're not coming back, most of them. We need to get new voters out. How do you get new voters out? You have policies that motivate people to vote. And Sanders' line is, the only way we're going to beat Trump is a huge surge in the voter turnout, and that has to be driven by young people in particular, and you have to give young people a reason to come out. Elizabeth Warren's essentially said the same thing. You need to have proper policies that you stick by. Unfortunately for Warren, she had a proper policy that she stuck by, which was what's known as Medicare for All, which is the public health care insurance, essentially. And then she started to retreat from it when the polls showed people were nervous about it. So she looked a bit more vulnerable and a little less sincere than Sanders does on these issues. But nonetheless, they're both in the camp of, we need real change if we're going to get people out to vote.
We've been talking about Sanders and Warren very much together in this conversation and about how similar their policies are. But there obviously are big differences between the two candidates as well. And this was on display earlier this month at a debate in Iowa when Elizabeth Warren said that Bernie Sanders had once told her that a woman could not become president.
Bernie is my friend, and I am not here to try to fight with Bernie. But look, this question about whether or not a woman can be president has been raised, and it's time for us to attack it head on.
He completely denies this.
Anybody knows me knows that it's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States.
Has this had any impact on the campaign and particularly on Sanders' campaign?
It did provoke something of a debate. We don't know what was said in that room. What was interesting to me at the going to rallies and just talking to ordinary voters about this is actually how little impact in the end it really had, partly because the Sanders campaign was able to diffuse it up to an extent by simply releasing his record, audio and video of him in the past saying he believed in a woman president. In the end, you know, because Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote by nearly 3 million, she actually beat Trump. Most people think, well, yeah, but it's clear a woman can win an election in this country.
At the start of this interview, you told us about how rural and white Iowa is as a state. Is there a bigger question about whether Iowa should be the place that sets the tone for the rest of the Democratic selection process?
Yes, and it's part of a very big question about the way the whole electoral system works in America and whether it's very democratic at all. Certainly, there are a lot of people who look at this and say, the way it works in Iowa mitigates against minority candidates. I mean, it's worth noting that in this state that's 86% white, and as we said, you know, a good part of it is rural, the two principal African-American candidates, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, ended up dropping out. They didn't do well. They couldn't get the momentum. They couldn't get the money. And you do have to ask yourself a question. Would that have been the case if, say, New York or California had been the first state to vote? Probably not, I'd suggest. It does, though, on the plus side, have the advantage that because it isn't, by American standards, a state with a particularly high population, because it's therefore accessible, the population's accessible, it means that the candidates do have an impact. Their campaigning has an impact. If we were to say that, for instance, you began in America's most populous state, which is California, I suspect because it has such a big population, everything would come down to television advertising and social media. And in the end, you'd be talking about the billionaire candidates having the advantage.
Chris, we're months away yet from the election, but this has already been a very long campaign for Democrat candidates, and the polls have been changing a lot. At the moment, it looks like Bernie Sanders is a few points in the lead and Biden's behind him, then Buttigieg and then Warren. But interestingly, all four of them have been in the lead at some point in Iowa. What do you think that tells us?
Well, firstly, it tells us we have to treat polls with great caution, as we learned from 2016. And also, it's perhaps worth noting that there's those polls for Iowa, but the national polls continue to put Biden in the lead. There's also a third set of polls which are worth looking at. Whilst all of the candidates or most of the front runners would beat Trump in an election, it looks like, at least as things stand, they'll only beat him by quite a small margin, which tells you how tight things remain. Now, that will obviously play out during the election. But I think the polls that we see in Iowa really tell us, firstly, about that split we were talking about, is that really there are these two camps. Now, if the polls are right, the winner and number two are Sanders and Biden in no particular order, then I think it becomes very defining. The campaign rapidly becomes very defining on those two. And what you'll see, I suspect, is quite a lot of the other candidates will start to drop out.
You're there now, Chris, and you're going to be covering this tonight. Are you a bit excited?
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's, you know, who the president of America is matters to the rest of us, to the whole world, as people have, you know, gathered only too clearly over the past 3 years. One of the problems of the past has perhaps been that, you know, in 2016, even back in the Al Gore versus George Bush Jr., plenty of American voters said they're all the same. Well, it turns out they're not all the same, and who's president does make a difference. It'll be interesting to me to see which path people go down. Are they voting their hopes, which is for change? Are they voting their fears, which is for Donald Trump could stay on?
It could be a new dawn tomorrow. Chris, thank you so much for speaking to me.
My pleasure.
That was Chris McGreal. You can read all of his reporting from across the Midwest at theguardian.com and follow The Guardian's US team throughout the night as the results come in on the live blog. Coming up, Iman Amrani on modern masculinity and talking about a taboo. Now, around the world, one in three men have been circumcised, but it's still a subject many would consider taboo. As part of her Modern Masculinity series, which explores the issues facing men and boys today, Guardian journalist Iman Amrani has been trying to find out why.
It's often said that men think with their penises, but how much do they really think about their penises? That was a question that I posed myself after I went and asked men in New York if they would circumcise their sons. This was part of the second episode of the Modern Masculinity series, which was on male circumcision. I was shocked at how many men I spoke to who had been circumcised, who had never given it a second thought.
Probably up to my wife's choice, I don't know.
Honestly, I feel like you haven't thought about it.
But how much could you say you really know about circumcision? Male circumcision is the removal of the foreskin of the penis. It's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. But in the UK, the number of men that have been circumcised is relatively low. Only about 8% of British men have been circumcised. And usually they're from Muslim, Jewish or African communities. In the United States, however, the numbers are much higher. 70% of all adult men have been circumcised. Although now the stats are showing that around 40 or 50% of newborns are being circumcised, which means that attitudes are changing for one reason or another. But it is also thought that a third of all men around the world have been circumcised, which means it's an extremely common practice internationally. There are several different reasons why men might be circumcised. One of them is faith and tradition. Another one is hygiene. A lot of men believe that it means that they are less likely to have infections and more likely to keep clean. And there are some conditions that men have with the skin on their penis, which mean that circumcision makes it a lot easier for them to just go about their daily life. And the last reason is aesthetic. Some people say that it just looks better. So whilst these ideas have been knocking around for a relatively long time, there's an increasing movement pushing back and arguing against these points. The people who are campaigning against male circumcision are known as intactivists, and that's a mix of the word intact and activist. And intactivists want male circumcision to be made illegal. They campaign against it and they're very, very active, especially online. But it's quite a small community as well. And there have been lots of questions raised about some of the more extreme areas of the intactivist movement. In these darker corners of the intactivist movement, male circumcision has been weaponized and used against minority communities. So where the argument should really focus on bodily autonomy and their right to make decisions or looking at the facts, they've become very personal and have been used as a way of attacking Jewish communities, Muslim communities, and basically saying that they're backwards and barbaric in a way that has been really, really, really problematic. And a lot of this has been attributed to the influence of the alt-right. I spoke to a Jewish filmmaker called Ellie in New York, who said to me that
what happens with taboo subjects is the taboo breeds all sorts of crazy.
And I do think that's what's happened here. I think that because male circumcision has become so difficult to talk about, the people who are owning that space are people who maybe aren't the right people to have this conversation or to move it forwards. And I just think it's really important that men feel comfortable to have that conversation amongst themselves. What the video was trying to do is not tell men how they should be. It was trying to open up a door to a conversation that felt rational, that felt that it was asking the right questions and that men were being heard.
That was Iman Amrani, who hosts the brilliant Modern Masculinity series, which has been nominated for a Royal Television Society Award. If you've not watched it, you really should. Find it at theguardian.com. Thanks to Iman and Chris McGreal. Today's episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Anushka will be back with you tomorrow.